Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, September 25th, 2019. Thousands of residents flee Mawut town because of fighting and flooding, with an army spokesman saying the fighting is between rebel groups.
They were divided between those loyal to Riek Machar and the command of Korchwal Gate and the splinter group and the command of Wichan Potbok.
And relatives of a slain South Sudanese lawmaker demand justice. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or UNOCHA, says more than 10,000 people have fled their homes in villages in and around Mawut State over the past 2 months due to fighting between rival rebel factions and flooding caused by torrential rains. Onan Walter Solomon reports for VOA from Juba.
During an assessment needs survey last month, humanitarian organizations found an estimated 18,800 internally displaced persons surrounding Mawut town. In a humanitarian snapshot published on September 20th, the UN World Food Programme says that as a result of displacement and difficulty in accessing Mawut Center, Turu and Meridiet, a targeted supplementary feeding program was moved from Turu to where the displaced have settled in Lon Nuang, and services from Meridiet have moved to Yumbare. A senior SPLMIO official accuses the government of inciting communities in Mawut, causing the displacement of thousands of civilians in the state. Major General James Ochan Port, commander of the SPLMIO Division 5, who defected to the government on September 22nd, accuses SPLMIO leader Riek Machar of human rights violations. But SPLMIO information spokesman Mabior Garang accuses the Kiir administration of colluding with Port to cause the recent fighting between SPLMIO forces in the area.
When they create these counterinsurgency tactics of using communities against communities, it is not an accident, it is deliberate, so that the peace process is destroyed, and they are trying to portray the SPLM, SPLAIO as the obstacle to peace, when it is them that don't want peace.
South Sudan Army spokesman Lul Ruai Kong strongly denies accusations that the government caused conflict in the area.
They were divided between those loyal to Riek Machar and the command of Korchwal Gate and the splinter group and the command of Wichan Potbok. So these were the two SPLAIO commanders that were fighting among themselves. Mawut is not under our control. It is under their control. The only place where we have presence is Pagak.
Meshak Malu, the FAO representative in South Sudan, says the fighting and displacement of civilians in Mawut has disrupted the UN agency's attempts to distribute seeds to households to help locals cultivate and harvest their own food.
When the season is over, even if we distribute the seeds and the dry season come, the farmers are not going to be able to plant. And even if they plant, then the results of their farming is likely to fail. In these areas, we have a distribution of about 6,000 households.
Malu says the fighting has forced humanitarian agencies to relocate aid workers. UNOCHA reports that as of September 16th, at least 10 humanitarian workers were relocated for safety reasons. Malu says the FAO is ready to resume humanitarian activities as soon as calm returns in Mawut. He is urging the parties to the peace deal to restore peace in Mawut and across the country so that people can once again produce their own food.
Almost as we are coming to discover in South Sudan and in other places around the world as the Food and Agriculture Organization, that peace is the first seed that we need to sow on the ground. And then we can follow up with sorghum, we can follow up with wheat, we can follow up with maize.
According to the United Nations, Mawut and surrounding areas are hosting a significant number of refugee returnees who are already displaced by the recent fighting between rebel groups. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Juba.
His relatives of a South Sudanese member of parliament, Simon Dang Bol, who was gunned down in March at Manjang in Nasir, want the government to track down and arrest his killer. Gakuth Dang Bol, the slain lawmaker's oldest son, says since his father was killed while he was on a mission to explain the revitalized peace deal to constituents, the government has done very little to hold the killer or killers accountable and has made empty promises about conducting an investigation. Bol says 6 months after his father's death, the family is still waiting.
I'm not happy because it's going to 6 months now since the killing of Honorable Simon Dang Bol Jack, and there is not any respective measures taken by the parliament or another government body. The president himself gave orders to form a committee to head the investigation on the incident that happened in Nasser, like George said. But then nothing is done out of all these things.
Have you gotten in touch with members of the parliament or the speaker of the National Legislative Assembly to understand why the government has not formed any committee to investigate the killing of your father?
I got in touch with some of the MPs that went to my father to the ground at Nasser, like George said. They're trying to level base for the committee to be formed. They're trying to pressure the parliament to raise a motion where at least it can discuss how we can handle this kind of issue. Because it's not 6 months, because nothing is done, no investigation is done. Actually, it's even, I think the government forgot about it.
And why would you think the government has forgotten about it? Because I remember when your father was killed, the government issued a statement saying that the perpetrators of that incident will be held accountable. That was a strong statement.
Yeah, it's indeed a strong statement. But then me as a son who lost his father, at least if they did a step whereby it can convince me that these guys are really trying to do something, I'll be convinced. But then now it's 6 months, but they did nothing. Nothing convinces me that the government is trying to help me out. Nothing is convincing me that the government is trying to help my family. Everything is stuck like that. Like, there's no improvement.
What is your demand that you want the government to fulfill?
I don't need much from the government except justice to prevail in the assassination of my father. Because Honorable Simon, when he went to Nasser, it was his own. I remember the president called them at the Spelem House, trying to tell them that you guys should go back to your state where you came from to try and disseminate the revitalized peace agreement. So they were sent. He didn't go for a vacation. He didn't go and visit. The government sent him to go and sensitize, to go and educate people about the signed peace agreement. It wasn't his own choice. So I blame the government. I blame him for the death of my dad. Because my dad actually, he didn't grow up in Nasser. He went to Nasser, I think, twice. So he has no problem with the people of Nasser. He was targeted because he was with the government.
You are using strong words here. You're saying he was targeted. Who targeted him?
Because the incident happened at the control areas of IO, which we all know that, which is Mandang. Mandang area is controlled by the IO.
Have you made your feelings known to the IO? Because you are accusing them here. This is an accusation.
Yeah, of course I'm accusing them, because the incident happened in their control area. And when my father went to Mandang, he went to meet the governor of IO. And the incident happened 6 minutes after leaving their control area. 6 minutes after leaving the place where the governor was. Now, you look at that time. 6 minutes leaving that place, people were shot.
Have you spoken to the senior leadership of the SPLM-IO about this accusation?
I haven't, because to reach site top.
Why have you not spoken to them?
I had no access to them, because most of them, they are out in Khartoum, some are here.
No, but the deputy...
Heavily guarded, meeting them is difficult.
The deputy chairperson, the deputy chairman of the SPLM-IO, Henry Odwor, is a member of the National Pre-Transitional Committee. He's in Juba, he's available. Have you made an appointment to meet him?
Indeed, he's available, but then meeting such a top politician is difficult here in South Sudan.
You are blaming the government for not having formed an investigative committee, and you are blaming the IO for being responsible for the killing of your father. Looks like you are not happy with the government and the rebels. How are you going to get justice in this situation?
The only way to seek justice is just to use my voice. Because as you see, I'm powerless, I can't do anything. But what I can do is just use my voice to speak out, go on TV, go on social media, speak in radio. That's the only way I can seek for justice.
Have you met the Speaker of the Assembly?
I met the Speaker of the Assembly, but then he gave me promises. I mean, you know, politicians usually give empty promises.
What did he promise?
Like, he promised to meet the chairman of NPTC, Turkey, who actually he hasn't gone to the parliament and been questioned. And the minister of the security also been brought. I think they discussed some issues that I don't know yet. I haven't got the information, the exact information what they discussed about. But then it was close discussion.
That is Gatkuth Dengbol, son of slain South Sudanese lawmaker Simon Dengbol, who was shot and killed last March. Deng spoke to my colleague John Tanza from Juba earlier today. Traders in Juba are welcoming a government decision to ban overloaded trucks from crossing a bridge over the River Nile. Last week, the government ordered security personnel guarding that bridge to prevent trucks from coming into Juba from Uganda and Kenya on that bridge that some officials say is ready to collapse. Viola Elias has more for VOA from Juba.
At immigration and custom checkpoints in Nesitu, about 7 kilometers from Juba, hundreds of truck drivers coming from various points in East Africa stands idle as they await clearance from the immigration office for imported goods. Kenyan Francis Kajanga, who is driving a truck loaded with food products, says he is impressed with the government's decision to offload overloaded trucks on the eastern side of the Nile River before crossing the Juba Bridge. Maximum capacity for the bridge is 45 tons at the speed of 20 kilometers per hour. Kajanga says it is no secret that the bridge has become fragile in recent months.
It was last month. I was crossing the bridge. The other truck behind me also came. I see the bridge doing there. Yeah. It is becoming quite weak. Well, what I can say, the trucks from Kenya, Kenya's government is very much strictly. You cannot overload.
Truck driver Wycliffe Otieno imports beer from the Kenyan port of Mombasa. Otieno says in years past, trucks would be overloaded when crossing the bridge.
When it comes to the safety of the bridge, I think it is everyone's concern because we are using that bridge to ferry the goods from this side to the other side. So my fellow drivers, everyone should take precaution.
Truck driver Simon Peter Okello, who imports goods from Uganda, says the government must strictly regulate the movement of heavy trucks.
There will be little costs. One of the little costs will be the transport cost between here and Shirikat, and also the loading and offloading costs that will be incurred in the process. So I will not say that it will be zero cost. There will be a bit of cost on it. But the truth of the matter is that we have the opportunity to carry it in bid.
Information Minister Michael Makwe said last week the newly appointed Minister of Roads and Bridges has tabled a report before the Council of Ministers about the Juba Bridge, saying it is on the verge of collapsing.
The bridge can collapse before even the Freedom Bridge could be completed. Those who are using heavy trucks are advised to think otherwise. If you are coming from there with a heavily loaded car, you reduce the load. You can put it into other smaller cars and then they will cross. But if you are coming with that heavily loaded car, which some of them are over 50 tons, and even sometimes 75 or 100 tons, this cannot be allowed to cross this bridge, otherwise the village can crumble before time.
But Makwe made no mention of any government plans to repair the bridge. Brigadier General Gideon Manuar, head of engineering in South Sudan Defense Force, says he has stationed soldiers at the bridge to ensure that heavily loaded trucks do not cross the bridge. Manuar says monitoring trucks at the bridge is a challenge because sometimes drivers of overloaded trucks escape without notice.
We used to stop them and then to unload some of them down so that it can be lighter, not to break the bridge. This is what we are doing. But there are some people who cannot understand. If you tell them, they say this bridge is belong to the government, not belong to you. They don't know this bridge is belong to them. They say it is just belong to the government. Government will repair it.
Manuel says he recommended the National Minister of Roads and Bridges to immediately contact all construction companies operating in Gumbo to erect a warehouse to hold offloaded construction materials. Simon Akwedeng, Secretary General of the National Chamber of Commerce, says he understands that offloading heavy trucks on the eastern side of the Nile will increase transportation costs for traders. But he says that it is better than allowing the bridge to collapse.
I carry 5-4 like that because I carry the goods like that. Like a trailer, they're supposed to carry 20 when they cross the bridge. They're supposed to one be cross, after they cross, the another one they follow.
Akwe says the government must do all it can, including borrowing money to repair the bridge before it collapses. Japan is constructing another bridge on the Nile River, 5 kilometers away from Juba Bridge. Freedom Bridge is due to be completed in 2021. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Zimbabwe's food insecurity is the worst it's been in years. Find out why when we return.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is most special about you?
I don't like disappointing people because of my actions. The way it pained me when somebody has disappointed me, I think about the same pain that I will cause to someone whom I have disappointed.
I'm someone who is very friendly, and I can interact with different people without considering their conditions and their status.
One thing special about me, I love the way God has created me, and I love being myself. I don't need to disguise myself like somebody, or I don't need to put myself, pretend like someone. I appreciate the way God has created me.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The World Food Program says Zimbabwe is facing its worst case of food insecurity in recent history, with special attention needed for urban poverty. The UN agency says economic decline, recurring drought, and the recent cyclone Idai are the main reasons. The United States has donated about $42 million, but WFP says the aid will only reach about half of those who need it most. For VOA, Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Eddie Rowe, the head of the World Food Program in Zimbabwe, says about 5.5 million people will need food assistance until the next harvest begins in April. Rowe says for years, the need for food assistance was confined to rural areas, but now some 2 million people in urban areas need help as well.
We are talking of urban poverty, where you have not just food insecurity, but urban high rates of urban unemployment. So when you look at it now, what we are trying to do is to come together for us to be able to intervene in an integrated manner, so it's not just addressing food insecurity, but addressing urban poverty.
The Rome-based UN agent said this year it started food assistance early in Zimbabwe because of the ailing economy, recurring droughts, and the impact of Cyclone Idai in March. As to sum up the food insecurity situation in Zimbabwe, Rowe said,
"It's bad. Even though I've been in Zimbabwe for roughly just under 5 years, when you look at trend analysis and the situation right now, I think in the history of this country, you have more hungry people than ever before in Zimbabwe."
Brian Nichols is the U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe. He spoke this week after his government chipped in $41.9 million for food assistance.
"The agricultural sector in Zimbabwe has the potential to revive this economy. However, it has been jeopardized by years of mismanagement of resources. We support Zimbabwe's renewed efforts to tackle corruption, which, along with political reforms, can increase growth and investment confidence."
The government says irrigation is the key to reviving the agricultural sector and ending the food shortages. Conrad Zawe is the Irrigation Development Director in Zimbabwe's Ministry of Agriculture.
"We have got a very big potential of irrigation in Zimbabwe, which is currently underutilized. Zimbabwe has got a lot of dams and has got two big rivers, the Zambezi and the Limpopo, which can be utilized for irrigation.
The government, working with the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, is repairing irrigation schemes on the country's farms, most of which have been neglected over the past 20 years. The UN says irrigation can counteract the recurring droughts that have hurt Zimbabwe's farm output in recent years. Even with the irrigation schemes working, Zimbabwe will need several months to reap a new harvest and overcome the hunger so many of its people are experiencing. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
A number of former top Algerian officials, including two intelligence agency chiefs and former President Abdelaziz Bouteflika's brother, have been handed 15-year prison sentences by the country's top military tribunal for alleged corruption. One of the sentenced men says the charges were politically motivated. Edward Uranian has this report for VOA from Cairo.
15 sentences against four of the once most powerful men in Algeria were handed down in the middle of the night by a military tribunal in Blida after a trial which lasted just 2 days. Former intelligence chiefs Bashir Tartak and Mohamed Midyan were given 15-year sentences alongside former President Abdelaziz Bouteflika's brother and right-hand man Saeed. Former Defense Minister Khaled Nazar received a 20-year sentence in absentia. The four men, along with well-known politician Louisa Hanoun, were accused of conspiring against the army by allegedly meeting with a foreign intelligence chief to determine who would succeed ailing former President Abdelaziz Bouteflika. Bouteflika was forced to step down in April. Two presidential elections have been postponed since then as a widespread popular uprising roils the country. Acting President Abdelkader Ben Salah recently set December 12th as the date for new elections and appointed members of an electoral commission to oversee the vote. Deputy Defense Minister General Ahmed Gaid Salah, said to be the most powerful man in the country, says the military will remain neutral and not try to influence the election. Salah says that he would like to assure the Algerian people that the military has no political aspirations and that its only wish is to serve the country and its people. He maintains that the appointment of a new electoral commission to oversee the vote is proof of the army's neutrality. Hilal Kashan, who teaches political science at the American University of Beirut, however, contends the Algerian military is deeply involved in politics and that the former top officials sentenced Wednesday are being used as scapegoats to appease the public's wrath.
The deep state is very much alive. Figures are expendable, and you sacrifice them so that the military institution that runs Algeria remains intact. For the past few months, there has been a simmering uprising in Algeria. The armed forces stepped in to contain it, and by issuing these sentences, they hope that they could put the lid on the pot.
Former intelligence chief Midyan, known as General Taufik, called the charges against him politically motivated and maintained that he has fought hard to investigate and contain corruption.
J'ai lancé de multiples enquêtes sur de graves dossiers de corruption.
Midyan says he has fought hard against corruption, saying that the thirst for doing dirty business deals and doing them fast has overtaken the entire nation, and the lust for easy gains has put aside all morality. He says that criminal dealings by Algeria's ruling oligarchs sapped the economy and demoralized the entire country. Popular protests against the country's ruling business and political elites continue to fill the streets of many towns and cities across the country each Friday. Many of the mostly young protesters have been demanding that the country's political system be completely revamped. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The UN General Assembly is in high gear this week as world leaders, diplomats, and non-government organizations work on strategies to deal with the planet's greatest challenges. This year, the focus is on the climate, the UN Sustainable Development Goals, finance for development, universal health coverage, and gender equality. To find out more about the state of gender equality, especially in Africa, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Katya Iverson, president and CEO of Women Deliver, a New York-based NGO that partners with thousands of groups to promote empowerment of women and girls around the globe.
There are five big summits, but what we're focusing particularly on, putting that gender lens to everything that's happening, whether it's at home, whether it's at work, whether it's in the big picture economy.
Why are women particularly the focus when it comes to talking about climate change, for example? The world's warming for everyone.
They are the ones who teach their kids to swim when the waters rise. They are the one who will be forced to walk when the soil depletes. So, of course, they should also be on the decision-making table.
Now, what about universal health coverage?
Women are the caregivers, mostly. They are the guardians of children's health, family health, community health. And if we don't have a health system that responds to their needs, we will fail.
What are some of the health needs for women that the UN should be focusing on, especially in Africa?
One of the very important things to look at is women's sexual and reproductive health and rights, the right to decide and the ability to decide on their own body and fertility, who to love, who to have children with, when to have them, whether to have them, if they have them. That is very important because that is also what makes it possible for a woman to get that education, to be in that job.
What did Women Deliver actually do this year to prepare to bring these issues to the attention of world leaders at the UN this year?
What happened was when the negotiations for example, the big Health for All summit took form, we could see that girls and women and gender equality was left out.
That was Katya Iverson, president and CEO of Women Deliver, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. And that's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song, Is This Love? By Bob Marley. Listening to Jamaican musician Bob Marley with the song Is This Love? I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. We're glad you made us a part of your evening this evening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
We'll share.